You know those little like dry ball fit, like those little packs of silica gel?
Yeah. The ones to dry things out.
Yes. So I think one of them ripped open in my backpack and like one of the tiny balls ended up in the headphone jack of my laptop.
What? How?
It was like the perfect size. And I spent like 20 minutes last night with a needle trying to like jab it to get it to come out. And it's just not.
No.
So like I have to suffer through the laptop microphone.
It's great.
Oh no. Well, if it makes you feel any better, you don't sound as good as usual, but you don't sound as bad as me. So
I guess I'll take it.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll pause there.
Pause it. Why pause okay. it?
I thought we were gonna do like a regular human catch up.
Oh yeah, sorry. We can do a regular human catch up, but before we do that, I have something which I would like to go on the podcast.
Oh my god.
Which is, yeah, I've literally just watched a video explaining how to hypnotize chickens. And now I am filled with an overpowering urge to go next door where my neighbor has chickens and just try and hypnotize them all.
In the Mad Max version of the future, you just have like an army of, like an armada of chickens surrounding you.
That is how I will survive the apocalypse.
Exactly. Just being like, go for
zombies,
it.
No problem. Nuclear war, nothing.
Like. Wave after wave of chickens. Will you love me when my heartbeat stops?
When my heartbeat stops, will you stay mine? Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning in, coming back for more analysis of Emily Dickinson and Dickinson, the TV show. You are listening to Edicts on Edicts,
a podcast about Emily Dickinson. I wrote nothing.
Like, Kyle, this was like your one job.
I know, this
job.
Is my gimmick. This is, and I...
This is the thing you do. This is the bit you do.
I know. I was, okay, let me do this again. Okay, so...
Okay, no, wait, I've got one.
Okay, good. Oh, good. Okay, yes, do it.
A podcast about Emily Dickinson, but now she delivers babies.
She sort of just sits there and watches her mother. Well, I guess Emily Dickinson does deliver a baby. It's just Emily Norcross Dickinson does it.
Aha!
Hey.
Perhaps the episode really is about Mrs. Dickinson.
I feel like the show has secretly been about Mrs. Dickinson the whole time.
All along. Yeah,
oh my goodness.
All the time. From the very beginning. So today we are looking at Dickinson Season 3, Episode 2.
Yes. It feels a shame to be alive. Written by Robbie McDonald and directed by Silas Howard.
Silas, yeah, okay.
Yes, he's back, baby.
Nice. This episode is, I think, like, it's interesting because there's, in Dickinson, I feel like there's, like, peaks and troughs. And I'm not saying that the troughs are bad. That's not what I'm saying. But there's kind of, like, moments, there's episodes where a lot of things come to a head and there's a lot of kind of dynamic, dramatic tension.
Yes.
And then there's kind of like the troughs, which are more like the episodes where things unfold at a slower pace and it's a bit more like kitchen sink.
I feel like there's a certain amount of like necessary setup, like especially structurally within a TV show, like episode two is usually like a building block episode. So if you think of like the first episode of the season rips up the status quo and puts our characters into a new set of problems. Episode two has to elucidate those and show us what else can happen in the rest of the season. So it's sort of a reiteration, which if you look at this versus episode one, makes a lot of sense. Like we've got Austin being gross still. We've got Emily and Sue's relationship. We've got Lavinia sort of starting out on her journey of where is she going with her life. And then we have Mr. and Mrs. Dickinson navigating their relationship and Mrs. Dickinson delivering babies. And Maggie being the weird person that she is.
Maggie is just like the She seems to get progressively more unhinged with every episode that goes past. There were moments where I was like, if I was Sue in this situation with Maggie and Mrs. Dickinson, mm-hmm. I would be actually very worried for my safety and well-being.
Her pulling out those sheep shears.
Like, given a different lighting and a different soundtrack, that scene where they're in the back could have been from a horror film.
Same dialogue, same delivery, just different lighting.
Just different lighting. Maybe a different, you know, slightly different camera angle or something.
Yeah.
Just like a jaunty angle to give it that added.
We call it a Dutch angle. Thank you, Ben. We don't call it a jaunty angle.
I mean, the Dutch are fairly jaunty, if you ask me. Sorry to any Dutch listeners we have.
I'm going to have to check our metrics and be like, are we big in Holland?
The Netherlands, are we big? Yeah, just to sum up the episode, we begin the episode with Lavinia and Emily in bed.
Yeah, they're giving us what I asked for, which is a scene between these two sisters, finally.
Oh, God, I thought you were going to say, like, incest or something gross like that.
No, I don't crave incest.
Good, okay. So, yes, Lavinia and Emily are in bed together, and they have a discussion about Lavinia's life and their father, who has survived his heart attack.
Yes.
And Emily says, I'm not giving up hope. Then we go to a scene where Emily gets up and she visits Sue, and Sue's having, like, a massive breakfast. Emily talks about the difficulties with her family, and Sue says that she agrees with Austin and that the family's problems perhaps can't be fixed and things. And then she kind of elucidates on a fantasy she has of her and Emily and the baby kind of running off together and being their own family, living in a cottage. But then it turns out that Sue's about to have the baby. She goes into labor, and Emily runs off to get help. And Mrs. Dickinson says that she will deliver the baby because she has all this farmyard experience from the old Norcross farm. So while they're delivering the baby, we get this scene of maple sugaring, which I wanted to talk to you about because that was something I was not familiar with, and it seems like a very American thing.
I actually had a lot of thoughts about this. It is such a New England thing to do.
Yeah, so I'm quite, I want to hear a bit more about it because I mentioned it to my housemate Brian and she was like, oh, it's like in Riverdale where they have maple trees. And I was like, okay, I don't know. This was all just gobbledygook to me, but.
Just like Riverdale.
Yeah, which is something I never thought we would say on this podcast.
But, no.
Oh, that would be like a whole episode, like a Riverdale Dickinson
crossover
comparison. Like a crossover, yeah. That I couldn't imagine that. One of the Dickinson family members would have to get murdered and there would be a cult of some kind.
Is that what's happening in Riverdale? Jesus.
I don't really know what's going on in Riverdale at the moment, but I know that, yeah, there's like been a bunch of murders and there's a cult and they had a really, really patronizing, insulting arc about Dungeons and Dragons, which I disliked as a regular D&D player. It was very upsetting.
Okay.
Right, okay. Anyway, so at the maple sugaring, Fraser, aka Nobody, turns up and the friends kind of wish him luck / bid him farewell. Oh, wait, and also at the maple sugaring, Austin is there with Jane and he's just being generally...
Austin is gross now.
Yeah, he kind of is. Like, he reminds me of all the douchey people that you just don't want to hang out with, and yet who seem to always be at every gathering. I mean, not my gatherings because I surround myself with positive people, but yeah, a good host has a discerning eye. Mrs. Dickinson continues to deliver the baby, which I don't think I've ever seen Mrs. Dickinson smile as much as she does in this episode while delivering this baby. But Emily is disgusted by this.
I was like, I wrote the note that Emily seems to be playing the role of like husband in sitcom where he's always like, ew, my wife's giving birth.
That's very much the role that she plays. But then Fraser, aka Nobody, comes to visit Emily and they drink some, I think they're drinking like port or something
together. That's what I thought it was.
I don't know.
It's very funny to see Emily Dickinson drinking.
Yeah, it was. I thought that, and I thought that in that moment, I know we'll talk a bit more about it later, but I was like, oh, you can really see that like she's playing herself as an adult.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Like, this is Emily.
As Emily.
Yeah, yeah. She invites him in. Mm-hmm. She makes him port. They sit down together.
Yeah.
It's very, like, gone is the childish Emily from season one.
Thoroughly.
Yeah. Fraser requests a poem from Emily, and she gives him one that she had written earlier. And meanwhile, Lavinia and Mr. Dickinson have a scene where they grow closer because Lavinia is taking care of Mr. Dickinson, but she's angry with him because she considers some of the things Austin has said to be true. But Mr. Dickinson expresses concern about his brother, who is fighting for the Confederacy, and he says it's a shameful time to be alive. And Lavinia says that she is happy that Mr. Dickinson is alive because she doesn't want to lose him. Then Jane reveals to Austin that she's going to Vietnam to marry a Frenchman to forward the goals of colonialism. Yay.
No longer a widow.
And she breaks things off with Austin, leaving him saying, I hope your wife learns to take better care of you.
Ugh.
The baby is born. Austin and Emily have an encounter outside the house after Austin has pissed on the barn like a Japanese salaryman. And then Austin says, this is a house divided. Sooner or later, you'll have to pick sides. And then the episode finishes.
Yep, with Emily out on the lawn, thinking about what he's just said.
So it's an episode where there's a lot of kind of conversations. Like, there's a lot of dialogues in this episode.
There's a lot of pushing things forward.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like all the major relationships, I think, get a look in. And there's a conversation for each plot point, essentially. So it's a very logical, structured episode. So, Kyle, your thoughts? Anything leap out to you?
Yeah, my biggest note was, like, Emily during the birth scenes, and, like, the way that relationship is sort of played is comedic, but, like you said, there is something underlying their respective behaviors that I think speaks to that misalignment that we talked about in the first episode, where Sue wants to run off into the woods with Emily and have a family. And Emily wants to sit and write her poems.
Yeah, but it goes, like, deep in that. Like, I think one of the things that really stuck out to me in the episode is that I think nearly every character, apart from Austin, I think all of the members of Emily's family at some point or another insists that she helps them.
Well, because if you think about, like, Lavinia and Emily have that scene at the beginning, which again is something I had been asking for, these two sisters, like, actually interacting. It's interesting that Lavinia is having this moment to reflect and realizing that, like, she says herself that she's doomed, that she is going to be a spinster. And Emily saying, like, that's not true. Like, you will have people in your life because your family's still here. And I'm like, I made the note where I was like, yeah, but also, like, romantic love is different than familial love, Emily.
Yeah, one is not necessarily a substitution.
Yeah.
Yeah, one is not a substitution for the other.
Like, and I think it's actually quite bad to confuse the two.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can have an overabundance of familial love and still feel the lack of romantic love, and vice versa.
Yeah.
And it's true for all forms of love. Like, you could have a brilliant whirlwind romance, but be devoid of friendship, for example. Yes. Our needs are more complex than just needing love, full stop.
It's a question of which form of love we need.
Exactly. And I also think that this kind of thing goes back to what I was saying about the last episode, where I think you know, Lavinia's getting to a point in her life where she's looking back now and thinking, I regret the decisions that I made, or I made the wrong choices.
Yeah.
And I'm not where I want to be. And it's like, it is that moment where you have to come to terms with, this is my life, and what can I change, and what do I just have to make my peace with and get on with?
Yeah.
Which is a difficult thing, I think. I think that's, like, one of the sadnesses of growing up.
Yeah, they're all sort of dealing with the lives they have chosen. But I think Emily, again, is still in this sort of denial about what the actual issues facing the family and her personally are, because she's still convinced that everything will work out just fine.
Also, what I find really, really strange is that Emily suddenly seems to have this like ideal image of her family.
Yeah.
And what she doesn't seem to be accepting is that people age and things change.
Mm-hmm.
And that things are not going to remain the same. And Mr. Dickinson isn't going to be the loving patriarch, and all the children are going to be obedient, you know.
Yeah. He also never was.
No, exactly. And I think that's the amazing thing. Like, people will convince themselves of anything for their ideals.
That's
so
true. No, it is. It is. I made the note to myself where I was like, God, Emily keeps having all these speeches about like hope and how much hope she has and how everything's going to work out fine. And I was like, this reminds me of Buffy season 7, where literally every episode has her talking about like, we're going to make it through and everything's going to be okay. And it's just like, it kind of wears you down to the point where you're not paying attention anymore.
Well, this is the thing. Like, she has to keep saying it because
it's denial.
It's not true.
Yes.
And so saying it once is not enough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it was demonstrably true, then she wouldn't have to keep insisting on it.
Right.
But because it's not demonstrably true, she has to keep manifesting it by keep saying it all the time. I mean, that's true of life, right? Like, sometimes you can tell when people are not being 100% honest because they keep repeating, they keep insisting on their truth, even though it might be flawed.
Yes. So we've got Sue and Emily then. So I've been vegetarian for a while, but like watching Sue munch down on those sausages, I was like, maybe I'll have a sausage. that looks really good.
I do love sausages. Especially on a barbecue, I have to say.
Breakfast.
Oh, yep. No, you see, I have a weird thing. I cannot eat meat in the morning.
Oh, interesting.
Even the smell of meat in the morning makes me feel really like, if people have bacon for breakfast, I find that really sick. Like, oh, just gross. I wanted to say something about like Sue, when Sue's eating, like the scene begins with like an image of her eating a citrus fruit, which reminded me of the
immortal moment.
And I was like, but actually, like, this is like the ultimate lesbian fantasy in a different way, because it's like the two of us, strong, independent women, run off to the woods and raise this child together. And we don't need any men to do this. We don't need the family. We can just
go off and have our baby on our own. And our baby will be the best baby.
Yeah. And I was like, there's going to be the gay people out there for whom the sex scene in season 2 is appealing. And then there's going to be the gay people out there for who this fantasy is appealing. Like
this like cabin core fantasy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You're like, yeah, I get it. Like, bathtub, cool, but cabin in the woods.
Cabin in the woods with baby.
I did find this scene interesting too, because like Sue makes the point about, like, she also agrees with what Austin has said about Mr. Dickinson smothering his children, specifically in relation to Emily. Emily is a genius and her family has never understood her.
And has never acknowledged that. Like, they see her writing as something to be tolerated.
Yeah.
Not so much Austin and Lavinia, but her parents. It's always, whenever Emily does anything artistic, it's always not now, Emily. Or
right.
Don't embarrass us, Emily. And what's amazing is that Emily seems to have completely blocked this out. In this season, it's suddenly like she's so rebellious in seasons 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
Where has that gone?
I was going to say, like, season 1, Emily would hate this version of Emily.
Yeah, she would. She'd be like, oh my God, I sold out.
Yeah. like, where did that fire go?
Yeah, but also I think it's a truism, right? Like, parents rarely recognize parents see their children the least clearly.
Yes.
Like, that's my experience of being a teacher, mm-hmm. is that parents have no idea about the personality of their child, have no idea about the abilities, mm-hmm. or lack thereof of their child, have no sense of, like, the desires and worries and anxieties of their child.
Mm-hmm.
I think good parents understand that and make an effort to try and see their child without prejudice.
Right.
Good parents, I feel, try and not prejudge,
mm-hmm.
how their child is or will be or things like that. But most parents don't do that. And especially because a large number of parents, I think, see their children as extensions of themselves and therefore think that their child will share their anxieties and their values and things like that.
I can tell you that is not the case.
Yeah, exactly. It's not. So when she says, like, oh, they've never, you know, they've never seen, when Sue's saying this to Emily about how they've kind of never paid her any attention, I thought, well, that's really, like, that's, I'm afraid that that is, like, often how it is for, yeah. children. Their parents don't see that in them.
Well, because you usually need that third party, which Sue is, in order to see that, because, like, families are far too close together to ever notice that.
Yeah.
I was thinking again about, like, that generational divide that we had talked about before, where we have Mrs. Dickinson, who is like, oh yes, we gave birth to, like, all of the children and all of the livestock in a barn, and I'm going to do the same with Sue. Whereas Emily's like, should I go to the doctor? She's like, no.
Yeah, and it's kind of the insistence of Mrs. Dickinson that the way she did it, because she did it that way, that's the only way to do it. And there's a great reference to Queen Victoria where Maggie's like, oh, I hear she's using, like, chloroform now. And Queen Victoria swears by it. And I remember, because I've just read a book about Victorian history. And Queen Victoria was, like, really dubious about using chloroform.
Oh, really?
In childbirth. And then the first time she used it, she said it was so wonderful. And then for every child after that, she used chloroform. Amazing. Every single one.
She's just like, knock me out.
Yeah. So, wow. Like, at first she was like, women have never needed this before and I will go through it and blah, blah, blah. And then she used it and she was like, fuck me, like, just knock me out. Do you know what I mean? She was like, just put me out. Like, I don't want to know.
I will never know the experience of childbirth, but, like, I've heard it's excruciating. I did hear that, so a friend of mine in college did once have, or no, he twice had a kidney stone, but apparently the pain of a kidney stone, the women who have had them say that that is the closest to childbirth. So if you want to, men, if you want to experience the pain of childbirth, have a kidney stone and you will know.
It's something that I got told as well when I went to see the urologist at the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a scan of my kidneys and then yes. They were like, oh, you have, like, a stone forming, but maybe your body will break it down or maybe it will become a kidney stone and then have to be passed.
Right.
And they were like, if that happens, come straight back to the hospital and we will put you on morphine.
Yes.
Yep. I was like, okay.
Yeah, no, my friend talked about how he, like, was going to the bathroom and had to, like, press both hands against the wall and he just started crying because it was so painful.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so we have this birthing sequence occurring throughout the episode of Sue giving birth, and it's pretty funny. Like, again, I like Ella Hunt getting the chance to cut loose.
Definitely. The comedy episode comes from Mrs. Dickinson delivering the baby. And I love, like, the discussion where they're talking about dying in childbirth.
Oh, yeah. And
Emily's like, that's not going to happen though, right? And Maggie's like, slim hips.
There's no finer way for a woman to go.
Yeah, Mrs. Dickinson's like, the greatest sacrifice.
But no, Ella Hunt getting the chance to just be out there, I thought was hilarious. Like, so much comes out of her facial expressions in reaction to, like, Mrs. Dickinson and Maggie being like, what if you got on all fours and tried that way?
Well, it's kind of goes into that thing of like in the last episode where Sue is like, this is the happiest I've ever been.
It does not last.
No, but you know, she can kind of, pregnancy has suited her. Mm-hmm. And she just doesn't, it's like I said last time, like she just doesn't give a fuck. So
yeah.
So everything's kind of vaguely amusing, I feel, for Sue. Mm-hmm. Like even when she's talking about Austin, she's like, oh, I don't know, like he's out there somewhere, like
behaving
like a child, but I don't really care. Like I've got my citrus and sausages, like so.
Citrus and Sausages is an art house film. Somewhere. Someone has made that.
Waiting to happen.
Yeah, no, okay, so the maple syrup party. Let's discuss this because
maple syruping, like maple sugaring. So tell me about maple sugaring. Is this something that people still do?
I have been on a kick recently where I have been reading a lot of books about plants and trees, because sure, why not? And one of them, I guess there was a big kick maybe 2 years ago or last year where a lot of people read Braiding Sweetgrass, which is a book by a woman of indigenous descent who talked a lot. She is like a botanist and she wrote a lot about the intersection of science and spiritualism, specifically in regards to plants. And there is a long section about maple syruping and maple sugaring, where she talks about the process of it. And just, it is like Toshiaki says, where you need a long period of time before your tree is ready to harvest. But the mechanics of it are, as trees prepare for winter time, they start storing sugar inside of themselves to, you know, process throughout the winter, because photosynthesis is gone because all their leaves have fallen. And we damaging humans go in and take spigots and spouts and knock them into trees and take all the sugar out of them. Not all of it, but a lot. And then we boil it down and turn it into maple syrup, which I made the note because it's similar to in episode 2 of season 1 where Emily bakes that bread in like 20 minutes. And I was like, that shit has to rise for several hours. I was like, you have to boil the product of the maple tree for hours before you can do anything with it. like it is 2% sugar and like 98% water, and you got to boil that stuff down for hours before you can, like, you got to reduce it for hours before you can start pouring it over snowballs. Nice try, guys.
But then I guess, like, back then there was nothing else to do but sit in the forest for hours boiling the sugar down, right? Like, that was the day's activity. I guess you get out early, you put your spigot in the tree, and then you spend the rest of the day around the fire, like, just boiling it down.
Yeah,
and then by the time the sun goes down, you've got some snowballs.
I was like, they are probably pretty hammered by that point, I imagine, because they're all just like, you got to go out there, get the spigot, put it over the fire, and then you just get drunk, I assume, waiting.
Like, yeah, I guess so. I mean, it reminded me, I don't know, do you know Wassailing?
Wait, like like that from the song, like, here we come a wassailing? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, wassail.
I don't know what that is.
It's like the British version of maple sugaring.
Okay.
So we do it down here where I live, but people do it all over the country, but orchards, apple orchards, like the traditional drink in Britain in the countryside is apple cider.
Yes.
Which I think in America is non-alcoholic. Is that right?
Traditionally, yes. But you can find hard ciders more these days.
Right. Okay. So like in the UK, all cider is alcoholic, and it's a tradition every autumn around bonfire night, which is the 5th of November.
Yes.
But it could be any time around then, because it's linked to the pagan festival of Samhain, the Halloween.
Oh, okay. Sure. Yes.
Basically, the idea is that it's after harvest, you have all the apples, you've turned them into the first cider of the year. So it's when you'd have like the first barrels of cider for the year. So the village gets together and has a wassail, which is where you thank the trees for the harvest of the apples. And basically everyone goes out to your orchard. You get all the dead branches and like dead wood from the orchard, and you build a massive bonfire, and you have Morris dancers.
Right.
Dancing a Morris dance, of course. And you take the cider from the first barrel of the year and you pour it over the roots of the biggest apple tree as like a giving back to the tree the harvest you took from it. And then everyone sits around the bonfire and gets massively, massively drunk. And there's usually a lot of music and singing and being very vulgar. And we still do it. We still do it. I haven't been to one this year, but I went to one last year. Yeah, but people still do it here, but it's not as big as it used to be. It's like it's a dying tradition, really. But it reminded me of, that's what the maple sugaring reminded me of.
Yeah.
Because I was like, oh, like it's another ritual where you like go out and you spend time with the trees and...
Like, thank them.
Yeah, and get drunk.
Yeah. But yeah, I do have a friend in Vermont who has a bunch of maple trees and does do this. So it is having a bit of a resurgence at the moment.
Well, I think that's good. If anything that gets people
like
to get closer to nature.
Yeah.
And also to understand where things come from. Because like you can buy maple syrup. Even here, you can buy maple syrup in jars and things.
Right.
But how many people go back to the source, like understand how many natural resources go into producing one jar of maple syrup.
And how much time it takes. And it's such a massive process.
And the same for cider, which is why we wassail.
Wait, one thing before we move on. I did crack up with Abby, one of the local Amherstians, just talking about how she can't decide which seasonal thing she enjoys the most because everything brings her so much joy. The fleshing out of the side characters of Amherst has brought me so much joy.
Yeah, I like the side characters. Like, you can 100% see them living through their life in Amherst and being like, oh, those weird Dickinsons, like, doing their weird Dickinson things again. So I wanted to talk about a theme that I think comes along in the episode, and that is the theme of shame. And I think shame, to my count, was mentioned 3 times in the episode.
Okay.
In different contexts.
Mm-hmm.
But you'll have to tell me whether you think this is right or not. But
yes.
I think the first one is Mr. Dickinson says it's a shameful time to be alive. And he's talking about how hatred and division mean that we don't, that the people in the North don't really consider the Confederates to be people anymore. And so have become kind of desensitized to their deaths.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of says like this hatred and division is shameful. And I think that kind of connects to something that is said by Jane when she and Austin are discussing how she's going to go to Vietnam and get married and she's leaving him and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. He begs her to stay, but she says that she can't because he's asking her to live a life of shame, basically.
That Amherst is too small.
In this small community. And so that's her reasoning. She's like, no, I can't do that because I think she says in the previous episode, it's shameful as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so she mentions that. And then the final mention of shame, I think, that I caught was the poem itself. While Emily writes it, I think, while Sue is giving birth.
Yes.
She writes, it feels a shame to be alive. Mm-hmm. Which is like a contrast because Sue is literally bringing life into the world.
Yes.
But Emily's saying, oh, it's a shame to be alive.
This contrast between like giving birth and just... yeah, what it means to exist in a time of intense upheaval and violence.
So yeah, what do you make of the theme of shame, really?
It's an interesting sort of counterpoint to the perspective that Emily's been bringing this season, which is this like intense optimism and denial, and to then have her acknowledge like not the counterpoint, because it's not despair, but just the shame of existence in these sorts of moments. Jane, again, speaking of like the side characters of Amherst, like Jane's growth is actually very interesting. How she's, we've said, like being a widow becomes her. And there could be a certain amount of shame with that, being a single woman raising a child in this time period, but like she's sort of owned it and made the choices that she has to make in order to provide for her child.
And also she shows surprising mm-hmm. moral backbone.
Yes.
In that she's able to look at her relationship with Austin and say, actually, this is shameful and
yeah.
it is unhealthy and it's not what I want.
I should
for
not
me,
be
for my
this.
Child or for yeah. Austin. I mean, shame is very difficult. I think like guilt comes from inside yourself, but shame is something put upon you by others.
Interesting. Go on about that. Wait, I want to hear more. What do you mean? Like guilt comes from inside you, but who put the concept of like guilt there in the first place?
Well, no, I think that guilt is your internal moral compass. It comes from your principles and from so whatever those principles might be, however you got them, it's your principles. Mm-hmm. And like you could do something that is shameful, but which still makes you guilty. Feel that guilt.
Okay.
But shame is a social concept. Shame is almost like a form of embarrassment. It's a much more extreme embarrassment that's tied to your sense of worth and value. So like you can feel guilty, but that doesn't necessarily undermine your sense of self-worth or self-value or change how you appear in the eyes of other people. But shame is something that is put upon you by other people, and you could do something which is not, you don't feel guilty about that. Like you could do something that you are not morally, you feel doesn't morally compromise you, but people might still be ashamed of, because it will change how you are in your relationships to other people.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? Like, I think guilt is a much more internal thing, whereas shame is a much more external thing. It's about how other people perceive you and how you relate to your community and your family and,
interesting. I hadn't quite thought of it that way, but I see.
The reason I say that is because when I was at uni and we were studying models of ethics in cultures, one theory, I can't remember where it comes from, maybe someone can email us and tell us, but one theory was that societies, in terms of their ethics, divide themselves into two categories. They divide themselves into guilt societies and shame societies.
Oh, interesting.
Where people's ethics predominantly are decided by whether they're guided by their internal moral compass or whether they're guided by societal expectations of behavior. And like a classic example is America, the USA, is a very guilt-based society in many ways because of the Puritan work ethic.
Absolutely.
And because of Christianity. Mm. And Christianity is about your internal moral compass, right? Then Japan, where you are at the moment,
Japan
is a shame-based society, right? Because people care very little about what you do in your private life, and they care very little about your internal morals.
Yes.
What matters is that you don't do anything shameful.
Right. The larger functioning of society.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very much so. And so one is much more individualistic and the other is much more collectivist.
Collective. Yeah.
But obviously in both societies you have guilt and shame. It's just about where the ethical, moral emphasis has been placed. So like another good example would be, I think in America, you study the Scarlet Letter. Like a lot of people study the Scarlet Letter,
sure,
right?
Oh, we sure do.
As a book.
Again, as Louisa May Alcott said, Hawthorne can eat a dick. I do not like the Scarlet Letter, but go on.
Well, this is the interesting thing, right? When you read the Scarlet Letter, you are made to identify with the main character. I've forgotten her name.
Hester Prynne.
Yeah. Because she's not a villain.
No. Right? No.
You as a reader perceive the protagonist and you judge them not to be guilty.
Right.
Right. So you have this moral sense. That's where the moral indignation of reading these works comes from. Because okay. You have the moral sense of like, there is no guilt here.
Mm-hmm.
But what they are experiencing is the shame, the societal shame that's being put upon them.
Yes.
And so that creates the dramatic tension that drives the work.
Sure. That there's a divide between what the characters are experiencing and what we are experiencing as an audience.
Yeah, because there's two different moral metrics.
Sure.
At play. And that's the difference between guilt and shame.
When did America evolve out of that shame society? Because like there are clearly illustrations of like a bygone era within American society where it was all about like community relations. And I'm just wondering where that started to like dissolve.
Yeah, it's so difficult because, I mean, one theory is that as societies get bigger and reputation and you become more anonymous, reputation becomes less important. And so it becomes more likely that societies will base themselves upon guilt rather than shame, because suddenly shame is less effective when people don't know how to identify you. But the problem with that is that look at Japan. Japan is a massive society.
I was going to say.
And people are fairly anonymous in Japan. Like you walk around Tokyo, you don't know anyone.
Nobody
necessarily
knows anyone.
You know, just from looking. Exactly. But shame culture still dominates. So it's not it's not just about the size of communities that makes the difference. I just think that American culture, alongside, again, it goes back to capitalism, is incredibly individualistic.
Yes.
And so, and also people are encouraged to play dirty, as it were. And so, do you know what I mean? Like there's almost a
like the rise of neoliberalism that gave us a more guilt society? Like how recent is this? Because I can imagine like America during World War II being quite collectivist in a way versus like...
Yeah, and
the Reagan era onwards, moving into like hyper individualized.
I think we'll take a look at, so again, like we can use Japan as a useful comparison. Like, look at the heroes that America glorifies in its fiction. They are anti-heroes.
Which era are you talking about? Like right now?
Well, I think right now. I mean, even if we look at the look at the Marvel films, for example, right? Like, who is the like golden child of the Marvel franchise? It's Iron Man, Tony Stark.
Yes.
But Tony Stark is framed as, even though he's a millionaire, he's framed as, or a billionaire or whatever, framed as a rebel who doesn't play by the rules and who makes his own rules. And like, that's how he's framed in the narrative. But even go back to like films like Rebel Without a Cause and things like that.
Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah, exactly. But when you look at Japan, even to this day, the cool kids in Japanese schools aren't the ones that break the rules for the most part. They're the class presidents, you know? they're like the kids who get the highest grades.
Right.
The kids who perform well athletically. Yeah, like the academically successful kid is popular because the academically successful kid is successful for the class as well.
Even within like Japanese schools where you have exams and those exam results are posted publicly for the entire school to see. So you have a sense of how everyone is doing as a group, as opposed to like your score being given privately. No, it's interesting. I hadn't thought of the dichotomy of guilt versus shame and that idea of like hyper-individualism versus like collective.
I think the other thing about shame, just to say and add on to that, is that shame is quite insidious because with guilt, it is an internal thing and it's about, you know, you might be able to reach absolution for your guilt. Mm-hmm. You know, you might be able to make peace with it, but with shame, the only thing you can do really is because it's something that's put upon you again, for the most part. Obviously, there's like internal shame, there's internalized shame.
Mm-hmm.
But the only way that shame goes away is either that you say, I no longer care what these people think and what this society thinks, and I'm breaking away from it, or you have to be rehabilitated within your group. So it's a much more insidious thing. Should we look at the poem anyway? We'll see what Emily thinks about shame.
I wanted to, before we move on, in the scene with Fraser, I really appreciated that we start to see the nuancing, like the shading of hope, where he talks about, he says very specifically, sometimes the most hopeful thing you can do is look directly at the darkness and admit that sometimes things don't get better.
Yeah, actually, you're right. Like, I've got that written in my notes as well. And I think that's because sometimes hope is actually just about endurance.
Yes, admitting the truth and not being in denial, which, again, Emily is very deeply in denial. And this is sort of the beginning of coaxing her out. And we have our first overt reference to Dante and the Inferno.
Yeah, he says, you know, look at Dante. He
went all the way into hell in order to come out. Let's move on to the poem.
It feels a shame to be alive when men so brave are dead. One envies the distinguished dust permitted such a head. The stone that tells defending whom this Spartan put away. What little of him we possessed in pawn for liberty. The price is great, sublimely paid. Do we deserve a thing that lives like dollars must be piled before we may obtain? Are we that wait sufficient worth that such enormous pearl as life dissolved be for us in battle's horrid bowl? It may be a renown to live. I think the man who die, those unsustained saviors present divinity.
This is a heavy one. You feel the weight of this one.
It's funny. I mean, the shame guilt dichotomy isn't so useful because what this poem makes me think of is the term survivor's guilt.
Yeah.
Because I suppose Emily's saying it's a shame to be alive when
there are
other people had to die
in order to secure my survival.
Yeah. The price is great, sublimely paid.
Do we deserve it?
I was thinking. Yeah, I was thinking a bit about this recently because it's been Remembrance Sunday here in the UK.
Yes.
When we remember the dead that passed away during World War One and Two. Yes. And where I live, there's a very large war cemetery, very, very big. And cadets from the armed forces came down to see the cemetery and see the ruins of the military hospital that used to be in the village. Mm. They were walking. I was out for a walk. Just around the grounds of where this hospital used to be. And they were going around and having, I think a local historian was talking to the cadets about like the soldiers that came to recuperate in the village here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just kind of, you think about the huge number of people that died defending the liberty of my country, you know? And then for Emily, during the Civil War, you know, a lot of the conflict is around slavery.
Yes.
And so the concept of liberty is very important.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the soldiers are fighting for is the liberty of Black people, really.
Mildly crying. It's cool. Thanks, Emily.
So she also poses the question, are we that wait sufficient worth that life would be dissolved for us in Battle's Horrid Bowl. So she's very much drawing this kind of direct parallel of, are we worth the these cost. Men dying?
Yeah.
But then she says, I think the man who die, those unsustained saviors, present divinity. And so she is kind of ending on this note that says that the sacrifice is still divine. And I think you have to remember, like, a big part of Christian belief is that we are not worthy of the sacrifice of Christ. And yet, despite our lack of worth, that sacrifice was still made.
And that we must exist regardless.
Yes, very much so. I think that's what Emily is kind of drawing on a bit here. But yeah, also, she kind of, you can see in the poem that she envies that they go and make this sacrifice.
While others just wait.
Yeah. Mm. Are we that wait?
Sufficient.
And maybe that's the frustration of her position in life, in that she can't go and make this sacrifice. I think this is like more relevant in later episodes, but, you know, it's very easy to criticize Emily and her poetry, saying like, oh, well, she's not a war poet because she was never on the battlefield and she never saw these things herself. And and I've been a bit like that myself.
You have been.
What I've said. I have been, yeah. And I still stand by that. Like, it's to imagine it is not the same as to go through it yourself. Mm-hmm. However, Emily is a victim of her circumstance in that she is a woman in the 1850s. Like, she is not going to be handed 60s. A rifle and 1860s, yes. Fine. She's not going to be handed a rifle and, like, kicked out onto the battlefield. Like, that's just, she couldn't, even if she wanted to. Like, if she went to the front lines, they would be like, who is this deranged woman?
Like, get her out of here.
Car and, like, send her back to her father. Like,
that's interesting. Like, so this is a different way of approaching it, which is, I think, something that the show on a macro scale is kind of grappling with, which is, like, we have this idea of Emily Dickinson as, you know, the crazy woman who locked herself away in a room. But the show itself is positing, like, what options were available to her? Like, she was, as we said, a woman in the 1860s who had massive literary ambitions, and society was not built for her to pursue them. And we sort of see this again in later episodes with the black soldiers who have these limits placed upon them, who want to do more than society is willing to let them do. And so, thinking about this poem specifically, like, the people who wait are put there because of, you know, the way we have built society. And so what sort of frustrations come out of that? Like, it's not as though she is hiding by choice necessarily. She is hiding by the way the world is at the time. Given the limits of what she had available to herself, she must reconcile both her ambitions and this shame in order to produce anything, in order to leave the legacy behind that she is going to leave. And, like, is it worth it? Is the things she has chosen to do with her life, are they worth it? Are they worth the sacrifice? Are they worth this war? Are they worth what she has chosen to do? I don't know.
I've got a good companion poem for this one.
Good.
Which would be John Milton's 19th sonnet. And Milton was, he was similar to Emily in that he had eye problems. And he steadily went blind, and his blindness prevented him from working as much as he would like. And being a good Protestant, he had this sense that not working was not acceptable, that to be around and just be not doing anything was somehow shameful. But in his 19th sonnet, he writes, it's quite famous, God doth not need either man's work or his own gifts. Who best bear his mild yoke, they serve him best. His state is kingly, thousands at his bidding speed, and post over land and ocean without rest, they also serve who only stand and wait.
Mm.
So Milton is reconciling in this sonnet that it is kind of providence, so God's yoke, that yes. some people are brought to a point in life where actually they are helpless or useless mm-hmm. to society, perhaps. But actually, even those people still serve their purpose in God's plan, and that we must make peace. We must make peace with where we are.
That opening line, when you consider the eye problems, when I consider how my light is spent, and just knowing that, you know, he will eventually lose his sight.
Yeah, well, so the whole, so he says, when I consider how my light is spent, ere half my days in this dark world and wide, and that one talent, which is death to hide, lodged with me useless, though my soul more bent to serve therewith my maker and present my true account, lest he returning chide, doth God exact day labor, light denied.
Mm.
So again, it's this idea of like, he has this talent lodged within him, useless. So like going blind has made his talent useless. Like going blind meant he couldn't write his own work.
Right.
And he considered writing to be his greatest talent. So it's just that idea of like, what do you do if you are put in a position where you can't serve in the way that you think you should?
How do you push against that to do anything? Or accept the fact that this is just part of the way things are going to be?
Yeah, that's what he's saying. They also serve who only stand and wait. Like, there are sometimes, there are times when you can't do anything, and the best thing you can do is
stand and wait. Yeah. I spent a lot of time this past weekend just writing over and over again, like letting go of attempting to control, and just sort of, again, like what Sue is doing in the previous episode, where she just sort of surrenders herself to like whatever is going to happen. She has the baby, and that will be what it is. And there is a certain sense of peace that accompanies that.
Mm. Well, it's the great vice of the West is control.
Control and productivity, and one must go in order to prove one's worth.
Yeah, but also like, it's no longer acceptable to just be like, I don't know, or I don't have control.
Yeah.
Like we have to control our diets, we have to control our finances, we have to control our emotions, we have to control our relationships, we have to control our property, we have to control just everything
is like is a measure of control, and that is how we decide success.
That is how we decide success, exactly. Like, it's laughable that even in spirituality, right? Because because we have this guilt-based society now, so much of our spirituality is, oh, I have to achieve something to make myself more spiritual. I have to proactively become more spiritual.
There are fucking benchmarks for spiritual success.
Exactly. Yeah, like people are like, have you read this book yet? Have you gone on this retreat yet? Have you mastered this meditation yet? Have you bought these products yet to make you more spiritual? Like, it's, whereas the reality is like, spirituality is something you can't control. Like, either it happens or it doesn't. Maybe you can foster it. Maybe you can like put yourself in positions where
you can be open to it.
Exactly. But I don't think you can make it happen.
No.
And I don't think you can control it.
To force it is to fake it.
Yeah, to force it is to fake it. Exactly. Mm. 100%.
Shall we loaves of bread it?
I was going to say, first of all, also, we had a kitty cat. Because, so the kitty count stands now at 2, I think, because Lavinia had a kitty cat on the back of her hand mirror.
Really?
Which was like, I was like, oh, props department, you did props it again.
Department forever bringing it. Incredible.
It was a really cute hand mirror as well. I was like, I want that, but also I think I just look like Dolores Umbridge. So I don't think that's for me, really. But
oh no, does Lavinia grow up to become Dolores Umbridge?
This explains so much. Loaves of bread. I'm going to give it 5 loaves of bread.
I'm going to give it, I was like, I'm going to give it 6.5. It was fine. Move stuff forward. I'm okay with it. Didn't wow me.
For me personally, I felt the comedy didn't quite work.
Interesting. I quite liked Ella Hunt's comedy. I thought she was funny, so.
Yeah, I mean, Ella Hunt does it. She's understated. She always does a good job in every scene she's in, I think. But same for, what's the actress's name for Lavinia?
Oh, Anna Baryshnikov.
That's it, yes. She
of
always
the Baryshnikovs, in case you didn't know.
Oh, I didn't know. Yeah, they like father. A dynasty of actors.
What? No, the ballet dancer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's her father.
Oh, wow. I didn't know. Oh, I didn't realize.
Yeah.
That's quite interesting. Okay. Yeah.
I was that's her dad.
Wow, the world is small.
Indeed.
Well, everyone, thank you very much for listening to us go on and on.
Before we go, I want to say I promised people a limerick about Pandora, and here we go.
Yes.
There was a Greek lass named Pandora who ripped the lid off her amphora. All hell tumbled out. The world had a huge rout, but we still hold on to hope for her.
Oh, yes. I love that.
That's
so good. Do you know what? I think that should be on the gates of hell.
I'm just going to go and chisel off Abandon All Hope and be like, nah, I fixed it. Don't worry. It's better now.
I think Pandora would appreciate it. She'd be like, I started this, bitches.
I was just so curious. What was in that little jar?
Have you seen a fucking M4? They're like massive. Thank you very much for tuning in and listening to us waffle on, guys. We always appreciate having listeners. We like that. I am continually shocked. Like, Kyle's always like, the podcast is doing well, Ben. And I'm like, is it? Like, it's kind of like a fantasy to me. It doesn't really exist. But if you want to get in contact with us, you can. It's edicts, all lowercase, @gmail.com. Please do write to us. We do love hearing from people when they email into us.
Please validate me.
Yeah, Kyle gets like deep satisfaction out of it. I just enjoy it. So please do write to us.
Yeah. All right. Take care, everyone.
See ya.
Bye.
Bye.